The greatest power of ruling consists in the exercise of self-control. First century Roman philosopher Seneca.
So this is how liberty dies. With thunderous applause.
Welcome to Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause. I'm your host, Scott, and you've just heard from Uncle Ian. This week's podcast, we're covering two ancient Roman dictators, emperors of Rome, Caligula and Nero. Liberty Dies with Thunderous Applause is a history podcast obsessed with history's biggest dictators. We've created a knockout competition to determine the single biggest dictator of all time. Each episode features a matchup of two dictators where we discuss the life and times of each leader. The loser of each battle is eliminated from the tournament. The winner remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. In episode one, we spoke about Julius Caesar. I recommend you listen to that episode. And where we left Caesar, he was stabbed by the Senate after he decided to go rogue and declare himself dictator for life. A lot happened between the death of Caesar and our first dictator we're covering today, Caligula. Uncle Ian, just fill us in that little gap there.
So Caesar was murdered in 44 BC. That led to the overthrow of the Roman Republic and, not for the first time and not for the last, some civil wars. Caesar's general Mark Antony and Caesar's great nephew Octavian were able to defeat the assassins of Caesar, including Brutus and Cassius. However, Octavian and Antony were unable to retain their alliance. The Battle of Actium was the final showdown between the two of them, and Octavian's forces were victorious over Antony and Cleopatra. After this victory, Octavian became Augustus, a new start for him and a new start for Rome. Augustus never used the term emperor, but he never quite got around to handing power back to the Senate. He ruled for 41 years, dying in AD 14. Augustus was succeeded by his stepson and former son-in-law, Tiberius, by which time we had a dynasty in place. Tiberius's great-nephew was the next in line. So our first subject today, Caligula, Gaius Julius Caesar Germanicus, or Caligula. He came from a strong line. His father was Germanicus, a famous general, himself great-nephew of Augustus and grandson of Mark Antony. His mother was Agrippina, who was granddaughter of the revered and deified Augustus. Yes, in Rome, you could make a human into a god. So Germanicus and Agrippina were already related. They were in fact second cousins at the time of their marriage. And I guess after their marriage, they still were second cousins.
That's true.
Born at Antium, which is on the west coast of the Italian peninsula, in August of the year 12. Although, of course, the Romans didn't call it the year 12 on the top of their calendars. As far as the Romans were concerned, he was born in the years named after the two consuls for that year, were the two senior elected officials of the magistracy for that 12-month period, and that's how you named the year after the two consuls who were in place.
So it might have been the year of Scott and Uncle Ian.
Precisely. Although, Scott, from what we've learned about this podcast, I think our consulships would last a bit longer than 12 months because we know that you need to start with a good literacy program.
Yeah.
You need to start by making sure that you publish a book and make everyone buy it.
Yeah.
And to award yourself lots of medals. And a moustache helps. We know Gaius Julius Caesar Germanicus as the Emperor of Rome from March of the year 37 to January of the year 41. He managed to pack a lot into that 4 years. Now, you'll recall that his father was a famous general. So as a boy, his mother would take him on campaigns. and he became a mascot for the soldiers. The soldiers, in fact, made him a little pair of boots, for which the Latin word is caliga. So his nickname became Little Boot, or Caligula. His father died in the year 19, probably poisoned for political reasons. His mother died in the year 33, by which time his two elder brothers were also dead. Because they were all candidates for the throne, they had made a lot of enemies.
His mother, Agrippina the Elder, was put into prison by the emperor at the time, Tiberius. She starved herself to death. As we'll find out later, the Agrippina women are a tough bunch.
Caligula was raised by his grandmother. He became close to his great-uncle Tiberius when Tiberius was ruling the empire from the Isle of Capri.
Tiberius is a bit of a weird character. On the Island of Capri, had a very interesting predilections with little boys. He would be in a pool and they would run behind him and bite his ankles. Very odd.
Caligula became emperor at the age of 24, had no military background, had held no legal offices and no religious offices. He may have been complicit in the death of Tiberius by encouraging the Praetorian prefect to smother him with a pillow. Tiberius was in his late 70s at this stage, so that was only going to ever end one way.
Tiberius, the emperor, murdered Caligula's entire family and then brings Caligula out to the island of Capri and then says, well, you can be my heir. I suppose poor Caligula's wondering, okay, all right, I guess I'll just play by the rules and hopefully not upset him, but really nursing this animosity towards Tiberius, which resulted in the smothering with a pillow. Tiberius did have a suspicion about Caligula and the type of person that Caligula was becoming, once saying, I am nursing a viper in Rome's bosom.
It's also speculated that Tiberius was genuine in wanting to make Caligula his successor because by comparison it would actually make Tiberius look pretty good. Caligula had been made joint heir with Tiberius's grandson Gemellus. However, Caligula had him put to death, supposedly for treason. Now, that's a story all of its own. Caligula accused Gemellus of either using an ointment or ingesting an antidote to poison because he feared that he would be killed. It became a self-fulfilling prophecy because Caligula killed him for taking precautions against being killed. i.e., to fear being killed by Caligula was treason. So it's very circuitous.
How dare you think I'm the sort of person who would kill my enemies? I'm going to put you to death for that.
Yes. The truth was, in fact, Gemellus had a very bad throat infection, so he had a cough and he was taking medicines, but that was enough for his cousin to kill him. Germanicus had been a successful general on behalf of the empire, and after the oppression of Tiberius's regime, Caligula's accession was well received. He announced amnesties of those accused under the previous regime, supposedly burnt the criminal records, gave money to the needy, reinstated the gladiatorial games and theatre shows, and completed the public works that Tiberius had never got around to, temples and aqueducts. It was too good to last. In October of the year 37, led to extreme behaviour on the part of Caligula. This was possibly a legacy of epilepsy in his youth.
The change in personality.
Yes.
Major source for this, the person who has written the things down about Caligula, is Suetonius. At the end of the good period, Suetonius writes, "So much for the emperor. The rest of this history must deal with the monster."
Some of the types of behaviour. He replaced statues' heads, even that of Zeus in Greece, with likenesses of his own. Committed incest with all three of his sisters. He pronounced himself to be a god.
We've had Augustus declared a deity after his death, but the idea of him being declared a living god was pure sacrilege.
When he ran out of money for cattle to feed the wild beasts who were appearing in an arena show, he fed prisoners to the wild beasts.
So in one instance of cruelty, Caligula was supposed to sacrifice a bull to the gods by hitting it over the head with a huge mallet. At the last minute, Caligula had a change of heart. He decided instead to smack the priest in the head instead, killing him.
During his severe illness, one of the senators vowed that he would give his life if Caligula would be spared. When Caligula recovered and heard about this vow, he asked the senator when he was going to take his own life because he'd made a promise. He held him to that promise, made the senator kill himself. He reintroduced treason trials. He set up a brothel staffed by upper-class women to raise money.
That brothel was actually inside the emperor's palace.
He increased taxes, misappropriated people's wills and bequests. He fancied himself as an auctioneer, so he auctioned off people's jewellery, household goods, slaves, often from under their noses.
He supposedly enjoyed ordering servants to spread gold coins all over the ground so he could walk on them with his bare feet, even at one point going full Scrooge McDuck and swimming in the gold coins. And he had his own personal cruise ship built with a swimming pool on board. Well, that's excellent luxury living for a guy in the first century.
It does set the blueprint for the cruise ship industry. He was aware that he did not have a military reputation. So at one stage he was visiting the Rhine frontier. He used his German bodyguard to impersonate enemy soldiers, sent his own soldiers against them with orders not to kill. But because the alleged German soldiers retreated, he was able to claim a victory on the Rhine frontier. It was all mockery. He thought about invading Britain in the footsteps of Julius. He wasn't a good sailor. He called off the invasion and instead decided to declare war on Neptune, the god of the sea. The troops were ordered to gather seashells as their booty. That entitled Caligula to claim a triumph, and that was the Roman equivalent of a ticker tape parade and would only be awarded to successful generals. At one stage on one of these campaigns, Caligula wore the actual breastplate which had belonged to Alexander the Great.
On one of his triumphs, on returning from Germany, he decides to have a triumph, have a ticker tape parade to celebrate his military success. So he parades through the city of Rome, the supposed German prisoners of war, who were actually French people. He dyed their hair blonde to make them look like Germans.
Points for creativity. He suffered from insomnia. One of his senators reminded him that as a god he wouldn't need to sleep at all, but he justified needing sleep because I'm appearing in mortal form. Scott, let's talk about the horse. We've all heard about Incitatus. It means swift, was a favourite of Caligula, had a marble stable and a gem-studded collar. Incitatus had his own slaves. We've all heard the line about making him a consul. He threatened to make his horse a consul. That line was really made in summary of how Caligula viewed the Senate. It was mocking the senators. He threatened to make his horse a consul. What he was really saying was, even my horse could do a better job than you fools. It was partially a compliment to his fondness for his horse, but also it was a way to mock the ruling classes.
That was his favourite thing to do, to mock the Senate. You know, he would brag about sleeping with their wives in front of them. Everything he did was just to show that he had power and they didn't. The situation with the horse is no different. Although he did really love his horse, he gave his horse his own marble stall and a manger made from ivory. Being Caligula's horse would be a good gig.
Caligula did have an eye to history. And I'm reading from his biographer Suetonius about his new and previously unheard of spectacle. Caligula made a bridge across the middle of the Bay of Baiae to the promontory of Puteoli, a space of about 3,600 paces, by bringing them together, cargo ships from all around, anchoring them together, and then laying down an earthen road and then he would ride his horse from one end to the other. The reason he'd done that is because when he was young, he'd heard a prophecy that he would no more become emperor than he would ride a horse across the Bay of Baiae. And he made that prophecy come true after he became emperor.
Because he's like, oh, I'll show you, I'll make pigs fly. I am emperor, I can do anything.
Eventually, powerful freedmen and Praetorian prefects plotted to kill him.
The Praetorian prefects are his guard?
The Praetorian prefects are the guards, specifically charged with guarding the emperor and his family. In the lead-up to his death, Caligula was aware that he was a marked man. He'd heard a prophecy that he should be careful of Cassius. And of course, let's not forget that one of Julius Caesar's murderers was a Cassius. Caligula therefore sentenced Cassius Longinus, governor in the province we now know as Turkey, to death. Oops, wrong Cassius. The Praetorian prefect, based in Rome, Cassius Chaerea, led the plot in which they trapped Caligula while at the theatre. He was greeting young performers backstage. They set upon him with swords and daggers. Subsequently, they counted 30 wounds. They then killed his wife and infant daughter in cold blood.
They killed the infant daughter by smashing her into the ground.
Yeah, bashing her brains out. They were so determined that there would be no subsequent imperial leadership from the family. However, they didn't kill his uncle, who at the time was 50 years old, had been denied public office because he was lame and a stammerer. And Caligula had kept him alive as much as anything to be the butt of many of Caligula's jokes. His uncle was supposedly found in the palace, hiding from the plotters behind a curtain by a Praetorian guard, who quickly realised that if there was no subsequent emperor, that the Praetorian guard would be out of a job if the Senate proclaimed a republic. He and his colleagues decided to proclaim Claudius as emperor in order to preserve their jobs. And Claudius, although a republican at heart, is remembered as a steady influence. He led the conquest of Britain and ruled the empire for 13 years.
And they hated Caligula so much and quite liked Claudius that when he died, they remodeled the statues of Caligula. They remodeled his face to look more like Claudius. Up next, we're going to look at another excellent Roman emperor, Nero Claudius Caesar Augustus Germanicus. That is Emperor Nero. Nero was the fifth emperor of Rome, ruling from 54 to 68 AD. He comes after Claudius, the man who replaces Caligula. And Nero is famous, of course, for his debauchery and oversized ego. And being a Roman emperor, he had a pretty high bar to clear in that regard. His name was originally Lucius Domitius Anobarbus. Anobarbus means bronze beard because all the men in the family had red beards. Nero had the perfect pedigree to be emperor. His mother was great-granddaughter of the Emperor Augustus, and Nero's father was a Roman general who was around back in Julius Caesar's time, and he opposed Caesar and then joined with Mark Antony and Cleopatra after Caesar was killed. And then he switched sides, joining Mark Antony's enemy, Octavian, aka Augustus, because he didn't like how much power that Cleopatra wielded over Mark Antony. So Nero's father died when Nero was just 3 years old, so he was raised by his mother, Agrippina the Younger, sister of Caligula. She remarries and then poisons her new husband so she can marry the emperor, Claudius. I feel I need to stop here to stress how ambitious this woman is. She kills her own husband, marries her own disabled uncle, who has just killed his last wife, so he's not really a catch. And the ancient Romans, mind you, shunned disabled people even more than we do now. A man was judged on his physical prowess and oratory skill, and Claudius was disabled in both. And after marrying the emperor Claudius, she gets him to adopt her son by her first marriage, Nero, as his own son. She also arranges for Nero to marry Emperor Claudius's daughter, Octavia. So now Nero is the adoptive son and son-in-law of the emperor.
As well as having become stepson.
Because his mother married the emperor.
And Nero is also the great-nephew of Claudius before any of these marriages and adoptions take place.
I'm confused. I'm sure you're confused. Don't worry about it. Just know that Nero exists.
And if they celebrated Christmas, he would certainly have been invited to Christmas, probably multiple times.
He would have four seats at the table. So Agrippina does an excellent job of getting her son Nero into the emperor's circle. I'm not sure if they had world's best mother printed coffee cups in ancient Rome, but Agrippina definitely deserves one. This is the part where Uncle Ian tells me that coffee didn't arrive in Europe until the 17th century.
I've not read about coffee in any of the ancient sources. They seem mainly to drink a lot of wine, I guess because you never have to be designated driver if you already own a slave.
No world's greatest mother coffee cup for Agrippina, although it was rumoured Nero and his mother Agrippina had an incestuous relationship. That would mean that Agrippina not only had slept with her son, the future emperor, but also slept with Claudius, the current emperor, and her brother, Caligula, the prior emperor. So she's gone through three emperors.
Yeah, when they talk about keeping it in the family, I think that's where the phrase originated.
Nero becomes emperor in 54 AD when Emperor Claudius died. He was fed poisonous mushrooms by, have a guess, Nero's mother, Agrippina. Claudius had announced two heirs, Nero and Claudius's natural son from his previous marriage, a boy named Britannicus, named after Claudius's conquest in Britain. Upon his death, Agrippina ensured Nero was proclaimed emperor by the Praetorian Guard, the soldiers who guard the emperor. They had pretended that Claudius was still alive for hours in order to buy time to get their plans together. They actually made a show of bringing in entertainers to cheer him up, even though he was already dead. Britannicus was outmaneuvered, and the Senate had to accept that Nero was the new emperor. The next year, Britannicus was poisoned by Nero. Guards came to assist the poor dying boy, and Nero said, "Don't worry about him, he's just having an epileptic fit." So at 16 years of age, Nero is the emperor of the Roman Empire. The following period is referred to as the Five Good Years. Agrippina, Rome's most ambitious woman, attempts to rule through Nero, but he refuses to be her puppet. She loses her influence to Nero's tutor, Seneca, from whom we've already heard. Seneca is still one of the most famous Stoic philosophers in history. Being tutored by him is like being tutored in physics by Stephen Hawking. He also wrote plays, one of which is a satire, laughing at the late Emperor Claudius. Claudius is deified by the Senate. They declare him a god after he dies. It had become common to proclaim any decent emperor a god after his death. So this play, written by Seneca, was called The Pumpkinification of Claudius, and it makes fun of the notion of him being a god with his disability. In the play, Claudius rises to the heavens and speaks to the other gods, but they cannot understand him because of his impediment. I suppose they did not have political correctness back in 55 AD. Nero also laughed at his adoptive father's death. He joked that mushrooms were the food of the gods because, well, they turned my father into a god. This was because Claudius was killed by the poisoned mushrooms. Seneca, his tutor, is a good influence on Nero and helps produce the so-called Five Good Years. In this time, they forbade contests involving bloodshed, banned capital punishment, and gave permission to slaves to bring civil complaints against unjust masters. He even pardoned some of those who plotted against him. One person who wasn't pardoned was his mother, Agrippina. She became a bitter plotter after being relegated to the sidelines, so Nero decides to kill her too. It's one of the most bizarre attempts at murder I've ever heard. Nero asks her to join him for a meeting and provides her with a small boat to reach the meeting place. But the meeting is a ruse. The boat is designed to break apart in the water. So the boat sinks as planned, but Agrippina can't be killed that easily, and she manages to swim away. One of her maids treading water calls for help to one of Nero's guards and claims to be Agrippina, thinking that would help her. Of course it didn't, they were under orders to kill Agrippina, so they killed the maid. The old self-disintegrating boat trick may seem like a weird way to kill your mother slash political enemy. However, Uncle Ian, it is similar to other tricks dictators have used to kill their enemies. I'm thinking of Mugabe and Stalin, both using the staged car accident. So I suppose the disintegrating boat is the first century version of that. After the failed drowning, Nero had his mother stabbed to death in her villa. She apparently showed the assassins her belly and said, "Strike here, for this bore Nero." Nero also executed his wife on fabricated charges of adultery. Octavia's maids were tortured to produce false evidence against her, but they loved her and refused, one saying to her torturer, "Her vagina is cleaner than your mouth." The Roman people even restored statues of Octavia after they were torn down and covered them in flowers. However, she was executed and Nero presented her head to his new wife, Poppaea Sabina. She was already the wife of Nero's friend, but that didn't stop him marrying her. Poppaea didn't last long. She died of one of Nero's famous fits of rage when he kicked her in the stomach. Nero also married two men. He married one dressed in the male role, marrying a freed slave named Spearbearer, a superb name for a gay Roman. And he married a second man, a eunuch named Sporus. He married in the female role. Nero was dressed as a woman. That name Sporus is also a joke because he's a eunuch and Sporus in Latin means seed. Of course, these ceremonies were not legal because same-sex marriage was not legal. They should have had a plebiscite, Uncle Ian. When Rome was a republic, the plebeians had their vote, which was a plebiscite.
The trouble with running a plebiscite in ancient Rome is that they didn't have electoral rolls as up-to-date as they could have been. The Senate rolls and the electoral rolls were often revised whenever the emperor felt like he needed to sway support one way or the other. So the plebiscite was rarely used, and it was only used when you were fairly confident of the result.
While Seneca and Burrus ran the government, Nero became very interested in art and music and acting. He even gave public performances playing the lyre. The theatre gave him whatever acting gig that he wanted, allowing him to perform on stage. This did not go down well with the people of Rome. Musicians and actors were seen as untouchables, the lowest of the low. They were viewed with prostitutes as they sold their bodies for the pleasure of others. I hope they don't feel the same way about podcasters. Nero's involvement with the arts was an embarrassment to the people of Rome. They wanted an emperor to conquer and bring glory and not engage in this Greek-inspired effeminate nonsense. He also insisted on repeatedly playing the character Oedipus in the play about a man who kills his father to sleep with his mother, which was very awkward considering everyone believed he was sleeping with his own mother. When Seneca retired as his advisor and the man running the government, Burrus, died in 62, Nero really went off the rails. He went out drinking with his mates in disguise, getting into fights. He got a strange of going around bashing random people in a gang. Other hoodlums started to copy him because they would just tell the Roman guards they were part of Nero's gang and they wouldn't be arrested, and they kept going around doing what they liked. Nero bribed the populace with chariot races and gladiator fights and other festivals, which kept him popular enough to remain as emperor. He later forced Seneca to kill himself. Nero is best remembered for the Great Fire of Rome. The fire burned for 9 days and nights and is the worst fire in history until the firebombing of Germany in the Second World War. So it was quite a bad fire. Everyone has heard the saying that Nero played the fiddle while Rome burned. Firstly, that can't be true because the fiddle didn't arrive in Rome for 800 years. Rumors were that he was seen playing the lyre on the palace balcony, but he was not even in Rome when the fire started. So that's also not likely to be true. But the rumor summed up the people's attitude of Nero. He cared more about his frivolous and shameful artistic preoccupations than the fate of his own people. Many even blamed Nero for the fire. Nero himself blamed a tiny and quirky, suspicious cult gathering together for meetings people assumed to be sinister. This suspicious cult were the Christians. Nero, ironically, crucified the Christians in public squares. St. Peter himself was killed in these purges. Picking on the Christians was a mistake, for Nero because it ensured he would receive hostile coverage from historians once Christianity took over Europe. Politicians often argue that their opponents are on the wrong side of history. History doesn't have a side. The real danger is being on the wrong side of historians. But it was the aftermath of the fire that made Nero far more unpopular. To fund the rebuilding of a fireproof city, he imposed a fire tax. The people hate fires, but they hate taxes even more. It didn't help that he was building himself a palace the size of a medium-sized city. It was called the Golden House. Rome is built on 7 hills. The Golden House covered 3. Its centerpiece was effectively an ancient nightclub with a rotating floor with pipes that pumped in fresh flower petals. He had a 100-foot statue of himself out the front called the Colossus. The Colossus was later moved with the help of 24 elephants. A very famous ancient amphitheater was built next to the Colossus, which gave the amphitheater its name of the Colosseum. So after the failed Pisonian conspiracy to murder and overthrow him, Nero purged his court of his enemies, both real and imagined. He took this purge pretty far. He even killed ancient Rome's greatest poet, ostensibly for involvement in the conspiracy, but in all likelihood because he was jealous that the poet Lucan was a better poet. He then took an extended tour of Greece with 200 carts of men and supplies. He spent his time giving music and theatrical performances in competitions. Out of 1,800 artistic competitions, Nero won 1,800.
So that's even more than 98%.
Yes, that's right. He got more than 98% of the vote. Nero even drove a chariot in the Greek Olympic Games. That's pretty impressive. After Nero's return to Rome in 68, he failed to respond to a revolt in Gaul, modern-day France, and the empire began to fall apart. One morning, Nero woke up, and the Roman governor of Spain, Galba, had declared himself legate of the Senate and Roman people. His Praetorian Guard declared allegiance to Galba, and the Senate followed suit, declaring Nero an enemy of the people. Nero first attempted to flee the city, but when he learned that his arrest and execution was imminent, he killed himself. Although it wasn't that straightforward, he first attempts to drown himself and fails, then he attempts to stab himself and fails, eventually he gets one of his staff to finish him off. His last words were a lament of his greatness going to waste. Uncle Ian.
What an artist dies in me.
What an artist dies in me. This bloke is so unlikable. He's fantasizing about being some sort of artistic genius even when he's about to be executed for being useless at his actual job of Emperor of Rome. He's got Kanye's ego without Kanye's talent. In the years following, some people in Rome even refused to believe that he's dead, like Elvis or Tupac. So it's likely he was better liked amongst the people than he was amongst the senators that he routinely irritated. As we know from our sources, they were very much anti-Nero, but he did do some good things. He didn't embark on a literacy program, but he did manage to improve the fire standards of the city. The thing that he really didn't do that gets all the senators and the historians offside is he doesn't invade and conquer anywhere. Like Caligula, the reason he's considered a bad emperor is because he doesn't go invading places. Well, he goes to Greece and gives performances as Oedipus, which was the role he was born to play.
And for Nero, with no military background, no military interests, he was following a lame emperor who in his 50s had masterminded a feat that was beyond Julius Caesar with the incorporation of Britannia into the empire. So Nero did have a hard act to follow in that regard, but Scott, you're right, it was all about territorial expansion. And Nero not only did not expand the empire, he showed no interest in expanding the empire.
And by the end of his reign, parts of the empire were trying to break away. So we have to make a decision. Both of these emperors, famous for their manic behavior and willingness to kill the people who got him into the position that he's in. Uncle Ian, this is a tough one. They're quite close.
It is very close, and perhaps that's not surprising given that one was the nephew of the other. So there's a lot of family traits in common. In less than 4 years, Caligula managed to show himself to be extreme in so many ways. To me, the clincher is Caligula awarding himself a military triumph. That's the ancient history equivalent of having 16 medals on your chest. Out of these two, who's the biggest, baddest, meanest? I think it's Caligula, but only just, because Nero presided over the fall of the dynasty that had started with Julius and Augustus.
Yes, because he's replaced by someone outside the family.
That's right. So there were no more descendants of Augustus after Nero, and that itself is impossible to imagine within 100 years of Augustus. To me, especially when you take into account the short time for which he was emperor, I think Caligula is the crazier of the two. I think he outpoles Nero.
I think Caligula also gets ahead because of the deifying himself while alive, calling himself a living god. I mean, he's already the ancient equivalent of the president for life. Declaring yourself a living god is almost president for eternity. Nero does well, but I think he misses out. He's eliminated from the tournament.
Which is the first tournament in 2,000 years that he hasn't won.
1,800 out of 1,800. It's an excellent record. So congratulations to Caligula. Little Boots remains in the contest to be named history's biggest dictator. Next episode, it's ladies' round. It's a catfight.
We are going to look at a couple of well-known women throughout history. We're going to look at Catherine the Great, and we're going to look at Cleopatra.
Catherine the Great of Russia loves a coup. Excellent TV show just made about her called The Great. And then Cleopatra. Everyone thinks they know about Cleopatra because of her interesting love life, but a wonderful dictator in her own right. So we're going to be very, very keen to get into those two. All right, thank you, Uncle Ian. We'll see you next time for Ladies Round.
Thanks, Scott.
Uncle Ian, just mention on ancient Rome, we've got some interesting sources to look at because there's only a few biographers from which we have our information.
And that's one of the key things with studying ancient history is that you have to bear in mind where we're getting our information. In terms of contemporary writings, for the history of the Julio-Claudians, we have the Suetonius Lives of the Caesars. He wrote that in the early 2nd century while he was working for Trajan and Hadrian.
So about 100 years later.
That's right. So he had access to palace records, which certainly would have assisted. That's a key source for a lot of the facts, but Suetonius does love a scandal or two as well. So he doesn't hold back in that regard. The other near contemporary author is Tacitus, who was again writing in the very late 1st century, very early 2nd century, and he wrote the Annals of Imperial Rome, again covering that Julio-Claudian period. Both of them were writing with the benefit of hindsight, even 50 years, 100 years on, so they didn't observe the events firsthand, so we do have to be conscious of that. It's also worth mentioning that for people who are interested in finding out more about this time period, I'd encourage you to look at the excellent BBC series called I, Claudius, and it's based on the historical novels by Graves, and it's an excellent dramatisation. In the unlikely event you're looking for other podcasts, then I can recommend The History of Rome by Mike Duncan and The Emperors of Rome by La Trobe University.